Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. Jeff Fawcett and I come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health and the environment.
15 years ago, three books were published that sounded the alarm on the pharmaceutical industry. The Big Fix by Catherine Greider, Overdosed America by John Abramson, and The Truth About the Drug Companies by Marcia Angel. We interviewed each of these authors. Each had their own story to tell, but the general picture was that bad things were happening to health, to science, and to the economy because of the failure to control the pharmaceutical industry. I've been waiting these 15 years for someone to write the companion book on the other major medical industry, medical devices. Things put in your body to change the way it works. Things that, like drugs, too often cause harm. I'm happy to say that that book has now been written. My guest today is Jean Lenzer, author of The Danger Within Us, America's Untested, Unregulated Medical Device Industry, and One Man's Battle to Survive It. Jean Lenzer is an award-winning medical investigative journalist and longtime contributor to the BMJ, formerly the British Medical Journal. She has written for The New York Times Magazine, The Atlantic, The New Republic, Slate, and Mother Jones. Jean Lenzer, welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
It is very much my pleasure. I would like to ask how the Danger Within Us has been recognized as the companion to The Truth About the Drug Companies and seen as of kind of equal stature to it.
Well, it's very kind of you to suggest it would be equal stature. But yes, this book has gotten some good critical reviews from people like Marcia Angel and others. On the other hand, I've also been under attack by industry, and that's coming pretty fast and furious in an attempt to keep people pretty much in the dark about the harms of devices, which is, you know, that's an old story. FDA manages to minimize harms by not letting people know, and the most recent way they're doing that is by allowing summary reports, but also just by not keeping a very helpful database of harms.
Well, the audience that you're speaking to today has heard a lot on this show about drugs and drug companies and the potential dangers and risks of using those using pharmaceuticals in medical treatments. In scale and political and economic impact, is the medical device industry comparable to big pharma?
Well, if you look at just the expenditures on the devices themselves, no, it doesn't match drugs. However, what that doesn't include when you look at the expenditures for the devices is all of the surgeries, hospital charges, anesthesiology charges, and follow-up charges. Many patients are charged tens of thousands of dollars in follow-up every year, and some of them land up with very expensive battery replacements. For example, one of the devices I talked about was the VNS or vagus nerve stimulator device, and people are paying tens of thousands of dollars in replacement batteries. So there, it's hard to estimate. There's no known quantification, but certainly the device industry is becoming huge and it's extremely powerful.
One of the things that has happened with pharmaceuticals over the last several decades, really over the last 50 years, but high impact over the last 20 to 30 years, is that pharmaceuticals initially were used for acute treatments, and where they have self-consciously shifted to is the use of pharmaceuticals in chronic illness so that it's not just short-term treatments, but lifelong treatments. One of the things that I just wonder about is whether the medical device manufacturing industry is figuring out ways to move in that direction so that instead of just a one-shot deal with a medical device, that there are upgrades or who knows.
You put your finger on a huge problem, and this is the illusion of innovation. When innovation really isn't about bringing better treatment and better care to patients, it's about extending patents and it's about establishing market niches. So you see companies doing things like making very minor tweaks to a device and then charging patients to upgrade to that device. So many of these devices now are computerized. They have software that's unbelievable. They link up to Wi-Fi and connections, and doctors use machines to monitor what's going on with these devices and then have them come in every 3, 6 months, whatever, a year, for annual checkups and modifications and replacements. So, yes, it's estimated that as many as – actually, it's not as many as – it's at least as many as 1 in 10 people actually have a medical device implanted in their body. And it's really hard to imagine until you realize what all those devices are. I mean, it's everything from nerve stimulators to pacemakers, defibrillators, stents, cardiac stents. At one point, that was 500,000 people a year getting stents. That's dropping off a little bit now. Artificial joints, knees, hips, shoulders, breast implants, ear tubes, ocular lenses for cataracts. So a huge number of people are walking around with these implants in their body and often without much idea in terms of how harmful they can be. I mean, some of these devices have been wonderful and they have really changed people's lives for the better. So somebody who was unable to walk before and get out of bed because of a bad hip, you know, the ability to walk again with a new hip is fantastic. And the same thing for people whose hearts are stopping and they get a pacemaker. That can be terrific, or their vision is restored after getting a cataract lens implant. The problem is that massive numbers of people, hundreds of thousands of people, have very serious adverse reactions. And actually, many of them died, many, many deaths associated with devices. And to tell the difference between which ones you can trust and which ones you can't is very difficult. And that's why I wrote so much about the FDA, because really the only people who are supposed to stand as a bulwark between the commercialism and the profit-driven motives of industry and the public safety is the FDA. So, yes, even though hip implants have been wonderful for many people, on the other hand, one of the stories I tell is about Dr. Steve Tower.
Yes, that's a very interesting story. That was actually one of the next things I was going to ask you to talk about, was about the instance of Steve Tower. And from my perspective, the really riveting thing is that this guy is an orthopedic surgeon himself, and yet he had a very bad outcome. So if you would, please tell that story.
Yes. And what's so horrifying is, you know, people always ask, well, how can patients tell? And I always talk about Steve Tower because he's not the only one. There are a number of doctors like him who've landed up being harmed by devices. And that's why it's so important to examine the FDA. But to sort of speed backwards here with Steve Tower. So he's an orthopedic surgeon. He was relatively young when he started having hip problems. He was an avid bicyclist, and he would bicycle to and from work for tens of miles every day. And when his hip became so bad that he realized he had to have a hip implant, he was very active in picking out what he thought was the best hip device on the market. And he got a metal-on-metal hip implant. Well, a few years after the implant was placed, his hip, far from being better, became much, much worse. And then he also started having serious memory and mental problems. And he was puzzled by all this. And he found out that there was cobalt and chromium in the hips. And so he checked in with doctors, and they all told him, you know, doctors with the industry, the manufacturer, and they all said, oh, no, there's no problem. You don't have to worry about cobalt or chromium. He did a cobalt level on himself and found that it was extraordinarily high. So he insisted on having the hip removed. And when the surgeon opened up his hip, he had what is called metallosis, local toxicity caused by cobalt. And the surgeon said his hip looked like a crankcase full of dirty automotive oil. His tissues and muscles and tendons had turned to black mush. And in addition, he found that there's a long history of problems from cobaltism that caused thyroid disorders, hearing and vision loss, as well as mental disorders. And he was really stymied in trying to get the word out to U.S. physicians. And it turns out that doctors in Europe knew about this problem and regularly checked patients every 6 months for their cobalt and chromium levels because they were aware of the problem. Now, the question is, why did European doctors and Australian and Japanese doctors know about this, whereas U.S. doctors didn't? Well, some of that rests with the issue of mandatory registries. And in those countries and continent, they require that all devices be tracked, certain types of devices, that all of those devices have to be tracked and put into a registry. So they have a sense of how well something's working or not working. But in the U.S., we have no mandatory registries at all. The only thing we have are voluntary registries. And studies are very clear that when it comes to reporting adverse events, bad outcomes, doctors, hospitals, and industry are much more likely to report good outcomes and quite unlikely to report bad outcomes.
Now, just to be clear on the registries, this is a registry. These are registries not just for hip replacements, but for all implanted devices. Is that correct?
No. There are not mandatory registries for every implanted device, but there are some especially for some critical devices in other countries. In the U.S., we don't have any of any device for any sort, no matter how complex, how dangerous. There are no mandatory registries.
And so what there is actually, I interrupted your train of thought. So if you want to continue with the Steve Tower story.
The tragedy is that Steve Tower, you know, uncovers this problem not only in himself, but then he starts seeing it in some of the patients that he treats, and he tries to publish this information. And the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, express a lot of interest in publishing this. This is, of course, a public health concern to people in the U.S. And the next thing he knows, right before it's supposed to get published in the prestigious Morbidity and Mortality Weekly report that is put out by the CDC, they deep six it. And they deep six it because the FDA tells them not to publish it because the FDA is, quote, studying the problem. So it takes a few more years for this to come out in the U.S. literature. And still, most people are unaware of it. Most doctors are unaware of it. I talk to doctors all the time, and they're unaware of this problem. So we see things like this woman I talk about in the book who went into the hospital for heart failure. And she, too, was relatively young. She had absolutely no reason to have heart failure. Nobody could figure out why she was in heart failure. She didn't have coronary artery disease. She didn't have thyrotoxicosis. She didn't have any of the things that should cause a heart disease problem. And they land up having to give her a certain device to make her heart pump strong enough to get blood to her brain. That device is a pretty serious device to stick in people. And finally, her heart fails so badly that that device can't even keep her alive. And they have to do a heart transplant on her. And it's only after they do a heart transplant that they find out that she has two artificial hips that had been implanted years earlier, metal on metal hips. They do a cobalt level on her. It's sky high. They take out both hips and replace them. Her cobalt levels drop dramatically, and her heart, her transplanted heart, had also started to fail because they were unaware of this. And her heart condition improved once they replaced her hip implants. Now, that could have all been prevented had doctors in this country been kept up to date on this problem. But industry is very powerful, and they make sure that the public doesn't find out about a lot of these things. And they do it in a variety of ways. They do it by not reporting the bad outcomes that are given to them, and they do it in a number of tricky ways.
Well, I have to pause here, and ID the show. You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. I'm talking today with Jean Linzer about her book, The Danger Within Us, The Safety of Medical Devices, and The Medical Device Industry. So that's who you were about to start talking about, which I did have a kind of frame for how this is a dangerous system. But finish your thought on the device manufacturers.
Well, they have become so powerful, and you were asking me in comparison to the drug companies. In some ways, they are much more powerful even than the drug companies, and the drug companies are trying to mimic some of the wins of the device industry. And part of the reason it occurred this way is that drugs came under the control, the regulatory authority of the FDA in the 1930s. The device industry, on the other hand, didn't come under the control of FDA until 1976. And at that time, there were already a bunch of implanted devices on the market and in people's bodies. And they included everything from, you know, nerve stimulators to cardiac pacemakers and other devices. So they were able at that point, because they had already become these multinational Goliaths, to wrest certain kinds of wins from FDA and Congress that the drug companies didn't have, because back in the 30s, the drug companies weren't quite as powerful as the device companies had become by the 1970s. Things like Johnson & Johnson, which produces both drugs and devices, is one of the multinational Goliaths. Medtronic, certainly very powerful now. But at any rate, one of the things that they managed to wrest control of was the right to sue. And this is something that drug makers want to mimic in terms of what the device industry has won. The device industry, unlike the drug industry, has won the right to have what they call preemption. Lawsuits are preempted. In other words, patients can't sue device makers for devices that were approved by the FDA as long as the device functioned as intended. Now, the problem is plenty of devices function as intended and still kill people. And that's depriving patients, not only the patients who have the devices, of the right to sue. It's depriving the rest of the public of information about these dangerous devices that often only come to light because of lawsuits. And in fact, the FDA had always supported the right of patients to sue, saying many times we can't really know what the true harms of a device are until they're on the market. The right to sue is a protective right for the public. And it was only in recent years where industry has become much more powerful. They actually started installing their own people in the FDA. Dan Troy was an example of this. He was someone who went from industry to the FDA long enough to promote this idea of preemption so that the FDA actually filed against the right to sue with the U.S. Supreme Court when the U.S. Supreme Court issued the ruling that people can't sue.
And that ruling was in 2008, and for those who are interested, the name of the case is Regel, R-I-E-G-E-L, versus Medtronic.
Right.
One of the really wonderful things that your book does is to lay out a stew of problems in a way that is like in other way like the truth about the drug companies, but has its own distinct aspects to it. But you've talked some about the moving parts or the lumps in this particular stew. I think you lay out in the book, is we have the FDA, we have device manufacturers, we have medical professionals, practitioners, the people that patients are actually in contact with. And there's another piece that I like to distinguish in terms of the medical profession, that are the researchers, which are both public and private. public, including academia, but also to some extent to government researchers. And then the researchers working for the device manufacturers themselves. And then there are financial institutions, particularly insurance, both insurance companies and government insurance. And you make quite a case about how we're kind of in the mess we are because of the creation of Medicare. And then down on the bottom are patients who pretty much are in the dark and not very well protected. So you've already commented on the FDA. Are there other aspects of the FDA that are part of this, I'm calling it a stew, that makes it difficult to both get information that is useful and also to actively regulate both the conduct of the medical device manufacturers, but the medical professionals who presumably work for patients, but may also work for the manufacturers themselves?
Yes, and I like the way you put it as a stew. I often think of it as, you know, the patient in the center of a wheel and the spokes going out, and there are dozens and dozens of spokes going that are impinging directly on the center of that wheel, that go out to the outer edges of the wheel. And around that wheel is everything from some of the things you named, everything from the FDA to medical journal editors, some of whom have received tens of millions of dollars from industry, and they publish only, largely positive stuff for doctors to read, and especially in trade magazines, that's a problem, to advertising in newspapers, which has had its effect, to funding of patient organizations that are really front groups for industry, to training for doctors that's run by industry, to, yes, research. It's not just privately funded, but unfortunately, virtually all of our public institutions that are supposed to protect us, CDC, NIH, FDA, have almost completely capitulated to industry in that they partner with industry. And people don't realize how often information about drugs and devices has been distorted by these industry relations with CDC, with FDA, and with NIH. In fact, it's so bad at NIH that I tracked a study that promoted the certain treatment. And I was stunned that I couldn't get the data from it because there's something called the Sunshine and Data Act that says that if the public pays for research, the public should have the right to that, to those data. And so what I did is I downloaded all of the grants that were given by NIH over a certain period of years and looked at how many of them were ever released. And when I found that really, how many of them were transparent? Did they release data? And when I found that not one of them was released, I contacted the NIH thinking I must have made a mistake. This is unbelievable. There's a Sunshine and Data Act. And what they said is, and I have it in writing, that, quote, despite numerous requests, no data had ever been released under the Sunshine and Data Act. Because NIH has so frequently, they've so frequently partnered with industry. So this is a serious problem. But the other part of that wheel, when we think of the patient at the center, so we've got this fully round, I mean, every point, they've got their hands out, they've got their hand in the till. And this is the problem of profit-driven medicine. But the last really crucial piece is politicians. So Congress is run by people who have war chests that are filled by industry, and they are increasingly making phone calls when they're unhappy with rulings by FDA, and suddenly everything changes. So there's an episode that a lot of people don't know about. This is pretty stunning. There's something called DeviceGate at FDA, and what happened was scientists at FDA in the device division had unanimously voted against approval of certain devices. And then suddenly a phone call was made by a politician where the industry happened to be in that politician's state. I mean, we assume this was just pure coincidence, I'm sure. And the politician makes a phone call to FDA, and the FDA managers overruled the unanimous decision of their own scientists. So this is, I mean, there was one, and DeviceGate, what happened was these FDA scientists got so upset about what was going on and that very unsafe devices were being put on the market that they wrote to Congress, they contacted newspapers, they wrote a letter to Barack Obama. They really tried to get help so that people would know how these dangerous devices were getting on the market. So what was FDA's response? It was to harass them and to spy on them. They actually put spyware on each of these scientists' computers so that they could see everything, every keystroke they made by the second they were able to track. And they did this for a period of years. And they harassed and drove out and fired a number of the, I think there were originally 12 scientists who signed the letters. And they were repeatedly told, I think it was by the GAO that they, or maybe it was the OIG, that they could not harass these scientists for contacting the media, that that was their right. So what they did is they tried to say that the scientists were giving away trade secrets. And this leads me to another point that most people don't know, and that is I was completely unaware before I started writing about this, that there's something called trade secret deaths. Industry gets to say what it considers what they call CCI, confidential commercial information. And they actually legally can refuse to release the deaths of patients in certain clinical trials if they simply declare it as confidential commercial information. And I came across this when I was able to track the deaths of some patients during certain clinical trials that were not released by FDA. And I talked to researchers who would go to the FDA for unpublished data thinking that they were going to get the negative results that industry was unwilling to publish. And they had no idea that when the FDA gave them data, they were not getting all the data.
This was the MOD database that you discuss in the book. Is that the source for this, or one of them?
In the particular case I was discussing that I actually tracked happened to have been with drugs in their drug database, but the same thing is certainly true for the MOD database. So the MOD database is, yes, where you file adverse events, and identical problems have been going on there, particularly with industry just simply not reporting deaths and serious adverse events. The Star Tribune in Minneapolis has done some great stories on Medtronic failing to release over 1,000 serious adverse events and deaths from some devices. And this is a chronic problem. And industry, you know, industry is very accustomed to just assuming that certain fines might be the cost of doing business. So in one of the things I did in my book was to list a number of companies and the fines that they pay year after year after year after year for not reporting and doing. I mean, most of the time they don't pay any fines, but it doesn't bother them when they do because it's not affecting their bottom line.
It's a cost of doing business.
It is the cost of doing business. And if you look at their SEC filings, they list those costs of doing business as part of their filings. I mean, it's much cheaper for them to just be fined and still continue to get their massive profits. And the only way we can change this is to, A, we're going to have campaign finance reform and get politicians out of this so that they can't overrule scientists, and start paying for genuinely independent, publicly funded research. And people don't realize we don't have that now.
I'm going to have to take a brief musical break right now. When we come back, I'll continue talking to Gene Linzer, the author of The Danger Within Us, about medical devices and the harms that they cause and what we can do about it. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. You're in the right place. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. I'm talking today with Jean Linzer about her book, The Danger Within Us, The Safety of Medical Devices and the Medical Device Industry. Our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, has more information about this show and our archive of almost 700 shows, a free stream of today's show, and access to our archive of show recordings using a library card feature, which is now free and open access. To contact us, email us at admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. Jean, how can listeners learn more about the danger within us?
Well, in terms of various devices, it's rather difficult to learn, you know, how safe or effective many devices are.
Well, no, I was asking, do you have a website or some other content?
Yes, I do have a website.
Yes.
And unfortunately, I have been so inundated by people who have been harmed by devices that I have really been unable to respond to all the queries. And I'm hoping that we will see activists get involved in blogging at the website so people can contact each other. I've managed to connect some experts with certain patients, but I'd like this on a much broader scale. Well, I don't have to be involved. So anybody who wants to volunteer to curate a blog, like I say, we're getting many requests about many devices, and it would be a great place to connect experts and patients with each other, because they often are forming the most powerful kinds of groups that can make change. And an example of this are people who have gotten involved with mesh implants and eSure contraceptive implants, and they've become very active in looking at the problems associated with those devices.
We will have a link to your website on our in association with this show, but just so folks listening will know, what is your website?
It's jeanlenzer.com.
Jeanlenzer.
So it's J-E-A-N-N-E, Lenzer, L-E-N-Z-E-R.com. And there are a number of pages there that have some of the articles I've written that are freely accessible, more information about the book. And one of the things about the book is that I look not only at various devices, but I really examine in a way that lay people can appreciate medical illusions and how they arise and how they fool doctors, how many doctors have been fooled by the effects of devices and drugs. And I look at the way some drugs and devices have been accepted over the years, only to find out that far from saving lives, they were actually killing people.
Well, that was one of the things I wanted to ask about next in that realm, which has to do with the fact that the patient's primary resource is their practitioner. The kind of through line that you used so effectively in the book is the story of Dennis Fagan, who was an epileptic who had a vagus nerve stimulator implanted, put in him, and the torment he went through and the problems that he encountered with that device, and the help he both did and didn't get from his physicians, and why not he didn't. And some of them had to do with kind of the issues that you're mentioning now, which is just the limitations of what physicians do and do not have. So I think it would be a good question to have you address, which is, should patients assume that their physician is fully informed about a device?
Absolutely not. You know, and it's understandable. I mean, first of all, doctors are just inundated now. I mean, when I was in training many, many years ago, you know, there were maybe several hundred drugs. Now there are thousands and thousands of drugs, thousands and thousands of laboratory tests. Doctors are expected to not only know the pathophysiology of numerous diseases and newer diseases that are being understood, but all these drugs, imaging tests, devices, and it's truly impossible to keep up with everything that's new on the market. It's just physically impossible. You can't do it. There have to be mediating agencies and experts who can individually look at these things and tell us what works. But there's also another just very human problem, And that human problem is that we all want to get better and we all want to think that a treatment is going to help us. And there's a strong tendency, and we can show this statistically when we look at actual outcomes versus what are assumed to be outcomes by both patients and doctors. And what we found over and over is that when a patient gets better after a treatment, we assume that they got better because of the treatment. When in fact, many times patients were going to get better anyway, they may have in fact gotten better despite the treatment. And when patients do worse after a treatment, it's not very frequent that the doctor assumes it's their treatment that made them worse. They assume it's the underlying condition that got worse. So that's what happened to Dennis. And even Dennis was fooled by this. He thought when he was having more seizures that the seizures were just his own problem because he had a seizure disorder. It didn't occur to him that the device that had been implanted in his body to stop the seizures was actually the cause of the seizures. And this happens all the time. And you know, to understand that, I mean, part of how I got to this point of reporting this kind of stuff is because I too fell for this problem. And before I tell that example, I want to talk about just Vioxx. Think about Vioxx, in which this was a painkiller similar to aspirin that the FDA estimated caused an excess of 60,000 cardiovascular deaths. And my reaction to that was, wait a minute, why didn't we see that we were killing all these people when we prescribed Vioxx? I mean, we didn't see people dropping dead like flies. Well, that's part of the medical illusion. Most doctors only have, you know, you'll have a couple thousand patients in your panel. Many of them will be children, young adults. You only have so many elderly patients. They are the ones who tend to want to take Vioxx for their arthritis. And one of them drops, you know, how many of them die within a certain time frame? A few of them will die and they die of a heart attack or a stroke. And you don't know. You think, well, they were 70. They were going to die of a heart attack or stroke. You just don't know. And it's only through studies where you randomize people, have to be treated with one approach, have to be treated with another approach, that you can ascertain whether a treatment is actually doing more harm or more good. So we are really unaware often of whether we're harming people or not. And that's what happened with Dennis. Both he and his doctors assumed that his worsening problems were from his underlying epilepsy, when in fact he was faced with a very deadly condition caused by the device, because he wasn't having seizures at all, actually. What was happening was his device was stopping his heart instead of his seizures.
I wanted to ask, continue with a follow-on question about Dennis, because Dennis, as you describe him, was very far from being passive. In fact, he was an EMT.
He was a paramedic. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So he was not unfamiliar with medical terminology, medical processes, and he was very active in trying to get information. In fact, a lot of fairly bad things happened because he was aggressive about keeping abreast of his case. The question that comes to my mind reading about what he did and the setup that he walked into is, was there anything that he could have done differently to protect himself?
Yes, and that's always the toughest question I face, because what I think of is that, look, people like Dennis Bagan, who actually used to treat patients with seizure disorder in emergencies, and Dr. Tower, and other doctors who've been implanted with devices that cause them harm, you know, if they're not able to protect themselves, how can I tell anyone how to protect themselves from faulty devices? And the truth is that I really don't know any ways other than for people to come together and demand the kinds of structural policy changes we need to make a safer FDA that really is there to protect the public and not to protect industry. Because their primary focus now seems to be to treat industry as their customer. and how can they make it easier for industry? And in fact, that's very much their push right now. How can we make it cheaper and faster for industry to get stuff on the market? That's not the question we need to be asking. We need to be asking, how can we better ensure that devices that do go onto the market are actually safe and actually effective? And what we're finding out now is that quite a few devices that are on the market don't even work. They don't even do what they're supposed to do. And I want to give you one example, cardiac stents. About a decade ago, a study was conducted for people with stable angina, that is chest pain that you're not in the middle of having a heart attack. It's just everyday chest pain that people get can be debilitating, can be worrying, but it's not a patient who's in the middle of a heart attack. And it turns out that those patients with stable angina in a definitive study of 2,000 people who were randomized to either be treated with medicines only or medicines plus a stent. And what they found was no difference in the death rates among the two groups. They not only found no difference in the death rates, they didn't even find a benefit in terms of future non-fatal heart attacks. So the devices simply weren't even doing what most patients thought they would do. And when they did a survey of doctors back in 2014 and asked them, not doctors, cardiologists, and they asked cardiologists what the benefit of stents were, 66, about two-thirds of them acknowledged that the stents were only useful for pain and that they didn't do anything for mortality or heart attacks. Yet 88% of patients who were implanted with stents thought that they got the stents to prevent a future heart attack and death. Very good at fooling us. Well, and doctors.
Well, a question regarding stents particularly, but I think it's a more general one because I think there are some other instances regarding spinal injury that you discuss about this happening, is that devices can be implanted in the core, can be put in the course of some other procedure just because that's normally what you do. And the stent thing triggered this memory of someone I knew who had a heart attack, wheeled him into the emergency room, and in the course of working on him, put in a stent involuntarily. That is, he didn't agree to it. It was just, we've got the patient open, let's put this thing in. And the spinal thing that that also triggered that memory was when you describe in your book this, I forget the brand name of the thing.
Infuse. Which, but before we go on to Infuse, let me back up just a little bit, because a patient in the middle of a heart attack, right now we don't really have the kind of definitive study that we know whether it really helps patients, even in the middle of a heart attack, to have a stent. Yet it does appear that there are certain markers that do seem to make it that it may be useful in the midst of an evolving heart attack. So I want to separate those two groups, the large number of people who aren't in the middle of a heart attack versus those who are. So certainly the doctors in that circumstance were intending to help save his life and prevent the extension of the heart attack and limit the degree of death. But yes, I think what you point to about Infuse is relevant, because one of the patients I talk about is a patient who had a device implanted that he didn't know was going to be implanted or hadn't been informed of accurately in terms of what it was. And so, yes, doctors sometimes get in the middle of surgery and decide that they're going to use this, that, or the other sort of device. And that's another problem.
You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. I'm talking today with Jean Linzer about her book, The Danger Within Us, The Safety of Medical Devices and the Medical Device Industry. I wonder if I say this, well, actually, I don't have to say it a lot to my doctor because I've already said it to him a couple of times with emphasis, but whenever I come in contact in any medical situation, I say, I am a medical minimalist. Do the minimum that you need to do.
What a great phrase. What a great way to approach things.
And what's interesting is the lights go on when I say that. They say, okay, yeah. I get it. I mean, there's still a kind of flow of things that normally happens and all that stuff. It doesn't solve all problems.
I'm going to steal your line.
Now, please
do. Now, when I'm asked what people can do to protect themselves, that's probably the single most important thing. And you know, that's especially valuable, not only because you're staking out what your particular interest is, but it takes doctors off the hook to some degree.
Yes, that's absolutely right.
Yeah. Doctors feel obligated to do, quote, everything. And they're very fearful of not doing everything, that you're much more, and they talk about this among themselves all the time, you know, that you're much more likely to be sued if you fail to do something that is a known potential treatment than you are for not doing something.
Yes.
And so that's, I think that's a great line. I'm going to use it.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm a medical minimalist.
Yes. Well, there's another very useful phrase, which has to do with the physician side of things. There's a British physician who we've interviewed who does a lot of work around heart disease and cholesterol theory and so on. But he has a book out that's called Doctoring Data, which is actually an entire book dedicated to misperceptions and illusions of medical practice. And one of the things he talks about is there is this institutional environment, just as you said, that encourages physicians, medical practitioners to do something. We need to do something. And he says the motto you should follow is, don't just do something, stand there.
Stand there. Absolutely. And that's exactly, you know, the key character in my book who represents the good guys in doctoring. That is, he's well known for that phrase. Don't just do something, stand there.
Yep.
One of the hardest things to do in medicine, but one of the most valuable in this day of tremendous overtreatment. And if there is another thing that patients can do to help protect themselves, and that is to ask their doctor whether they receive any funding of any sort or any in-kind contributions, travel expenses, research, anything from the industry that manufactures the device that they're about to get. And frankly, I would say not just the device they're about to get, but of any device, because it turns out that studies show that doctors who are funded by one industry are much more likely to actually, far from being competitive with other industries, they're actually likely to be much more supportive of other devices. They want to expand the field and increase use of devices rather than limit it to just the particular device that they use. So
yes.
I'd say get out of town. If your doctor's paid for by Medtronic and he wants to put a Medtronic device in you, run.
I agree with that. Before, we've got about 8 minutes, 7 minutes, actually less than that. I want to make sure that we get to your discussion of reforms, that some of which are similar to what the three authors that I discussed at the beginning, notably Marcia Angel, discuss about how do we fix this mess? How do we make the stew edible? So I would like you to talk about those elements that I found was that one of the things that, as far as I can tell, you're fairly unusual in advocating is that the role of a single payer system in solving many of these problems, that and also changing the patent system, which has all sorts of implication. FDA reform, which you've already had touched on some, really enforcing academic independence. That I think is really, people don't recognize this, how infused, just like it's not only regulatory capture, but also academic capture that's happened.
Yes.
And that you, and unusually, that you pay attention point to the significance of the social determinants of health in doing these things. So I would like to give this over to you to discuss those issues and others that you regard as essential for the effective reform of the control of the medical device manufacturing industry.
Well, thanks so much for summarizing that in a really nice way of the number of issues that I addressed in terms of ways to reduce the harms caused by overtesting, overtreatment, bad devices. And yes, starting with single payer, right now doctors are reimbursed still on a fee-for-service basis in many situations. So there are surgeons who, the more they do, the more they're paid, and they are now multimillionaires. And I trace the history of doctoring from just as recently as the 1930s and 40s, where, you know, doctors were given a chicken and some potatoes for a visit. Hospital visits cost almost nothing because there weren't CAT scans and PET scans, and there weren't really any expensive treatments. There were cheap antibiotics and maybe a nurse to watch you when you had a heart attack and keep you in bed. That was about it. And then that all changed with the rise of the medical industrial complex. And now we have newly minted multimillionaire doctors, some of whom actually go to work in chauffeured limousines because they are interventionalists and they get paid a lot of money for these interventions. So we need to change that and single payer, putting doctors on salary, I think would take away that motivation to just make money by doing more. Not all, I mean, many doctors work for little. I mean, a lot of family practice doctors, you know, people would be surprised at how little some of them make. You know, I mean, they come out of school with massive debts and they might earn $110,000 a year, which is, you know, a lot of money compared to what some people earn. But at the same time, with massive debt, it's understandable that, you know, they have a hard time. But to compare them then to cardiac interventionalists or orthopedic interventionalists who are making multi-millions per year, we need to get rid of that. We could solve that problem and equalize it more so that family practice doctors, primary care providers get more money to spend time with patients, which is what they need, and slow down this cycle of overtreatment. That's one thing. And yes, I do look at, other things, from the patent situation to publicly funded studies. And what we need to do is stop partnering with industry. We've shown that that doesn't work. It biases the outcomes and it keeps the data from the public. And people think, oh, well, we've now got these clinicaltrials.gov register. It's, you know, where people are supposed to register their studies in advance. The problem is they're not posting their outcomes. And even if they do post their outcomes, we can't challenge those outcomes because it still doesn't obligate them to release the data that underlie those outcomes. And we know from other studies that industry tends to conceal bad outcomes. So there's a lot of changes that we need. And I hope people will read the book and and add in their own suggestions about ways that we could improve outcomes.
One of the things that going through that last chapter where you look at what we can do, that always comes to mind is the potential for the use of patient advocates. I know it's kind of a very small thing. There are people who do that, but that to what extent advocacy for people whose job it is to be on the patient's side so that they can actually be a resource for them.
Yeah, getting through the maze of different and insurers and, yeah, and things that are available is really difficult, but that's another reason why I support single payer. It's insane that doctors are now spending 2 hours on the computer doing bureaucratic stuff for every 1 hour of seeing a patient. It's insane. And what that's all about is tracking every single thing that's done for the sake of the insurers and payments. So we have a profit-driven system that is really depriving patients. So we have over-treatment on the one end because doctors are making more money for doing more, and we have complete under-treatment and lack of access to care for people who don't have enough money or don't have insurance on the other end. So we have these two extremes at once, and we could get rid of both of those extremes to some degree, or to a large degree, by having single-payer insurance, which every other peer nation has, and their outcomes are much better. I mean, we fall off the map in terms of our life expectancy being the worst of the, among peer nations, child infant mortality being the worst. I mean, our performance is not reflecting a good outcome from all that money we're spending. And then, yeah, social disparities, that's huge. That's probably the single most important difference in terms of lifespan and outcomes. And if we really want to help people do better in terms of health, we need to invest in community things like having jobs and, you know, having access to care and being part of a community. And that would go much farther than spending money on high-tech interventions.
Gene Linzer, that was a great pitch for single payer. So I want to thank you very much for this book that you've written and for the time you've spent with us today.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity.
You're very welcome. The book is The Danger Within Us by Gene Linzer. Gene is spelled J-E-A-N-N-E. Linzer is L-E-N-Z-E-R. And her website is genelinzer.com. Thank you for joining us today. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, for information about this and our almost 700 other shows, free access to recordings of all of them, a free newsletter about upcoming shows, and more. To contact us, send email to admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Jeffrey Fawcett. Until next time, take care of yourself.